This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here. So in that guided meditation, I talked about, you know, we can, with meditation, we can choose an object that we would like to pay attention to. Actually, it's such a wide range. It doesn't have to be any particular object. It's very common for us to talk about noticing the sensations of breathing. It doesn't have to be the breath. It can be the body or sounds, as I said. But we often have this misconception that there should be no thoughts, that meditation somehow is to get rid of all of our thoughts. How many of you had like zero thoughts? Right? No, I wanted to introduce this idea that instead of trying to get rid of thoughts, just notice them. Just notice the thoughts. But of course, this turns out to be quite tricky because we get lost in the thoughts and we start thinking and off we go. Go down the river, right? On these different boats. And I introduced this idea of boats to introduce this idea that there's different types of thoughts. There's families of thoughts that maybe are preferred ones or the ones that are the most compelling for us. And just noticing that can be really powerful and really supportive. A few things to notice. One, that thoughts arise and pass away. In the same way in the guided meditation, I was talking about how the boats would arise, go down the river, and then they're not there anymore. Chances are you have not had the same thought for this 45 minutes that we've been together, right? There's different thoughts. So to notice that they arise and pass away, and also to notice that they're a mixture. We may have a preference for certain types of thoughts, but chances are you've had maybe a whole lot of these types of thoughts, these types of boats, intermittent with some other type, and then maybe you're over here, and then maybe there's another one or something over here. Recognizing these two things, that thoughts come and go, and that we don't always have the same thought, or the same types of thoughts, I should say, can support this feeling of resilience. That's what I'd like to talk about tonight, is resilience. What is resilience? There's a lot of ways we can think about this. Part of it is being able to bounce back after a setback or a difficulty. Resilience is being able to not be stuck, essentially. It doesn't mean that the way that we're behaving or responding to our thoughts or responding to what we're doing is perfect. Doesn't mean that it's beautiful. It doesn't mean it's the absolute best or the most wise that we're capable of. Resilience means that we're doing the best we can, and there's a sense of movement, a sense of possibility, a sense of there can be something different, there will be something different. That's the key to resilience. If we think about it, often difficulties mean that we're stuck. That we're stuck. We can't see something different. We can't sense any movement. We can't see things beyond this feeling of stuckness. In fact, I would say that if it's difficult, it means we're stuck. They go together. Right? If you're floating down the on the boat, and you're lost on the boat, you don't even know in your boat, there's no problem, you're just going down on the boat, right? And then later you realize, oh, wow, okay, I didn't need to be there, I'm here back on the riverbank. That's not a problem. Just something has arose and passed away. So noticing our thoughts can be enormously supportive. And the Buddha talked about this, of course, in a number of different ways, in a number of different settings. Here's an excerpt that I'm going to emphasize certain parts and brazenly omit other parts, just to kind of support what I want to say here. If this were another talk in another setting, I might like spend more time on this, but... So this is the Buddha. He's talking to his followers. And he says, before my enlightenment, so before he was an awakened person, before he was like those of us in this room who are not awakened, before my enlightenment, as I abided, as he was resting, as he was noticing, as he was, I don't know, however you want to interpret abided, as I abided, a thought of ill will would arise in me. So he would have some, maybe some anger or some aversion or something like this. I understood, the Buddha continues, a thought of ill will has arisen in me. So he noticed. He noticed what the nature of his thoughts were. He continues, before my enlightenment, as I abided, a thought of non-ill will arose in me. We can understand non-ill will as being loving kindness. And he continues, I understood a thought of non-ill will has arisen in me. Right, he's noticing these ill will and non-ill will. Both of them are arising and passing away, and he understands, he sees that they're arising and passing away. And he continues with thoughts of cruelty and thoughts of non-cruelty. We can think of non-cruelty as compassion. He noticed that these would arise, and he noticed when they arose. He also says he noticed when sensual desire or greed would arise. And he also noticed when thoughts of renunciation or simplicity would arise. And when they arose, he noticed. He understood that they had arisen. So it's not that there isn't supposed to be any thoughts. And it's not that we should only have particular thoughts. It turns out to be enormously powerful to just notice that thoughts arise. They have a flavor, a quality, a attitude, and they pass away. Once we start to notice that, we will start to notice, oh yeah, these thoughts, when I'm stuck in these, when I'm thinking these a lot, tends to lead to less freedom, more stuckness. These other types of thoughts tend to lead to more freedom, less stuckness. The Buddha continues in the sutta and he says, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. I think many of us have done this, like kind of getting stuck is like just ruminating over and over and over, and we start to notice, like, oh, wow, I'm always thinking this and I can't quite get out. I think this is what the Buddha is describing here. And maybe that's when we're not feeling like we have some resilience, feel some brittleness, we feel like things aren't moving. When those thoughts are not supportive, when those thoughts are not leading to greater freedom, greater peace, greater ease. Of course, the Buddha, he laid out specifics saying that thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, and thoughts of greed and desire do not lead to greater freedom. But you don't have to take his word for it. You don't have to take my word for it. You can just investigate and notice in your own life. What kind of thought patterns are helpful and which ones are less helpful? So it's easy for me, or maybe I'll say this. We may notice that we have thoughts of ill will. I'll just use that as an example. It's difficult. It's difficult to notice this about ourselves. Or maybe there's a lot of grief for losses. It's not easy. I'm sitting up here saying, oh, just notice your thoughts. It can be really difficult to be with them. The message that we often get is when we are experiencing difficulties is like, just get over it, get back to work. Like, don't just pretend it didn't happen, just ignore it, or don't dwell on it, don't think about it. And I would say as a society, in general, we tend to really promote this avoidance of difficult thoughts and this kind of an obsession with distraction, wanting to distract ourselves from these difficulties, difficult thoughts, difficult emotions. And of course, avoidance and distraction is the opposite of noticing. But if we cannot acknowledge the breadth, the range of our experiences, our interior life, then we often stay on the surface of life, the surface of our experience. And we start to feel disconnected from ourselves. We start to feel disconnected from others. But it's not satisfying. Maybe a little bit more comfortable in the short run, but we start to notice that it leads to difficulties, even more difficulties. In the Buddhist world, we like to use this word suffering. I kind of like this word suffering, but it's a little bit dramatic too. Maybe you experience it as suffering. Maybe it's just this quiet uncomfortableness, like, oh, something's not quite right. I can't put my finger on it necessarily. I don't know what it is. Just not quite right. This often happens if we are just paying attention to a subset of our experience, not noticing the broad range of these thoughts that arise and pass away. But thoughts and feelings of grief, I'll use that as an example, are no less legitimate. They are no less real. They are no less deserving of our attention. No less worthy of our noticing them. I'm not saying it's our preference. I'm not saying it's not our habit to look elsewhere. But our life opens up. Our life becomes a little bit more rich, and we gain resilience when we can be with the broad range of our thoughts, of the broad range of our experience. But if we try to deny and avoid those thoughts or those parts of ourselves, we may feel like that they're parts of ourselves that are uncomfortable, then every time we encounter loss, we encounter a certain type of failure, a certain type of defeat, which we all do, right? We all do. We don't like to talk about it. We don't acknowledge it. We don't like to admit it, but we all have this. We all have this. If we try to deny and avoid them, then somehow we often end up kind of like at war with ourselves. Like, oh, get over it. You shouldn't do that. Or you shouldn't be thinking that. Or Maybe something along those lines. And this, of course, leads to greater suffering. Less ease, less freedom, less peace. So life, I would say, is asking us to meet it on its terms, not our terms, not when it's convenient, not when it's the easiest. I still feel a little tender about it, had a family emergency, and I guess they're not called emergencies when they're planned, when they have it on schedule or something like that, right? These things happen when they happen. And then we can't avoid them. But I also want to be clear, there is no reason to go into the most difficult, to go into the depths of our difficulties, to go into the most troubling. This is a practice. Meditation is a practice. Kind of the Buddhist practice in general is about noticing. So we can honor ourselves, honor our experience, and say, this part over here, this difficulty, is really difficult. There's no need to go into the most difficult. Don't start there. Start with what's a little bit annoying. Start with what's just a little bit irritating. And learn how to be with that experience, to notice those thoughts. Just like weightlifting or some other physical activity you want to do to get more healthy or to build endurance, in order to build resilience and to build our capacity to be with difficulty, we start where we are and we start where it's easy. So do you have a difficulty that's a little easier than the others? It's the exact same skill, it's the exact same experience to work with the easy ones than to work with the difficult ones. Start where it's easy. It's amazing. We often think, right, we have this, I know I certainly did for a long time, this idea, no pain, no gain, right? I had to like just push. Professionally, personally, athletically, you know. I spent decades for a long time kind of like pushing, thinking that was the only way. It's not the only way. There's real wisdom in being with and noticing what's a little bit difficult and say, okay, here's an opportunity for me to practice that person standing in front of me in the grocery line is talking so loud on their phone. Just practice with it. Just notice, like, okay, here's some thoughts of ill will arising. What does it feel like? Okay, can I let it go? Oh, there's another thought of ill will. Just notice, start with those things. I'm talking about, you know, being with the whole range of our experience, but there's, again, I kind of want to say there's no need to jump in the most difficult. What you'll discover, what I've discovered, is that as I start to work with the easy, difficult things, somehow other things, they would arise when I had the capacity, when I could work with them. Sometimes I'd feel a little bit overwhelmed, like, oh, wow, okay, this is a big thing. This is really difficult. And then later I would practice with that as well as I could, like, okay, that was really hard, and I did feel overwhelmed, but okay, maybe we don't know how. We don't know exactly how, but we got off that boat. We find ourselves on another boat, like, okay, phew. But just noticing, and not expecting that we can do the most difficult or that we can do it beautifully. We're not doing ballet. We're not singing beautiful songs while we do it. Maybe we're tripping and falling, and maybe we even cuss a little bit when we're tripping and falling. But resilience is about the sense of movement, not getting completely stuck. It's not about being the most beautiful. That comes with practice. We start to get a little more ease, a little more, I don't know, grace with difficulties. And then with this family emergency that happened for me, I was so happy. I was so happy that I was able to support others who don't have a meditation practice, who haven't been looking at the range of their emotions and noticing. I'm not saying I was perfect, but wow, it was so meaningful for me that I had kind of worked with my resiliency, my capacity, so that I could support people I loved while something difficult was happening. We shouldn't underestimate the power of that. I'd only support myself as best I could, but to support others as best we can. So this practice of just noticing our thoughts to help cultivate resilience isn't asking for perfection. It's asking for some authenticity, what's actually happening. And to recognize with some wisdom, maybe I don't need to go into the depths of this difficulty right now. Maybe I just need to notice, yeah, there's this one boat that just keeps on coming up, and it just goes to a place that I get stuck on for a long time. And it's not helpful. I don't really have the capacity right now to be with it. So instead, we can just notice, oh, okay, here I am on that boat again. Sometimes, just that noticing is enough to bring us back to the riverbank. Not all the time. Sometimes it is just that simple noticing the types of thoughts, the type of boats that we're on. There is this this Irish philosopher, John O'Donohue, has this phrase called the reverence of approach. Honestly, I don't really know what reverence means, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't mean filled with condemnation and criticism. And it feels like reverence of approach maybe is something with respect, some care, some honor. And he goes on to, and he says, when we approach things with reverence, great things decide to approach with us. What are these great things? Maybe it's a spark of wisdom. Maybe it's a drop of patience. Maybe it's compassion. Maybe it's open-heartedness. Maybe it's giving other people the benefit of the doubt. This reverence of approach. So can we notice what our thoughts are? But can we notice in an open-hearted way? Maybe you have your own meaning for reverence. So John Donohue, he's pointing to, what if instead of trying to outmaneuver our difficulties, our grief, what if we came to it with reverence? What if we treated our difficult thoughts, our difficult emotions, as being worthy of our consideration, worthy of our time? What if we consider trying to find a way to engage with it, to sit with it, as best we can? Again, we're not looking for perfection. Just to notice, and maybe that's all we do is to notice. So I said that noticing sometimes is sufficient to bring us back onto the riverbank, so to speak. But not always. But before we can, maybe we can't even notice. Maybe we just, these difficulties come and we just don't know how to be with them, and we feel overwhelmed and all our wisdom and out the door and everything we ever learned right with difficulties. That happens. And then somehow, maybe we find ourselves with a little bit more presence. But there's some things that we can do to make it easier, to create the conditions to make it more likely that we'll be able to notice when things are difficult, notice our thoughts, and therefore not get so lost on them. All of us have strategies that we do when things are difficult. Maybe some of them tend to be more helpful than others. Things like spending some time in nature. This is what I like to do. I find myself, I have this thing about trees. When things are really tough, sometimes I'm saying, I need to go hang out with the trees. Redwood trees, please. I feel so lucky to live here in the Bay Area, right? That we have trees. Redwood trees. There's something about, for me, I don't know, their majesty. Oak trees are nice too. They're kind of gnarly and they grow in all kinds of crazy ways. So somehow I'd love those too. Maybe you have your own thing, nature, the beach, the ocean, the water, the river. Maybe hearing some birds. Maybe nature isn't your thing. Some people would like to exercise. Maybe spending time within water, swimming, taking a shower, taking a bath, something like this. When things are difficult and we just feel like we can't just notice them, what's happening. We can use other strategies to support us. Maybe sometimes we just need like a strong kick to get us out of some rumination or feeling overwhelmed, and we find ourselves watching cat videos. I saw this video recently of this little baby deer. I couldn't help myself. I was just watching this baby deer. It kind of, you know, it warmed my heart, and it's helpful for this kind of difficulty that me and my family are experiencing. Maybe knitting or, you know, some other kind of activity, so doing something with one's hands. So recognize that we all have strategies. Some of them, just look at them. Notice which ones are helpful, which ones are not so helpful. And then do what you can to do more of the helpful ones and less of the not so helpful ones. And notice the thoughts that you have around the not-so-helpful ones and the thoughts that you have around the helpful ones as best you can. As best you can. We're not looking for perfection here. We're looking towards like a movement, an inclination of the mind to be present with what's happening. I'm talking about difficulties kind of in the theme of these talks here. But of course, we would do the same things with pleasant, just to notice pleasant things and notice if we tend to want to grab on to them or do whatever we can to perpetuate them. So all these things that I mentioned about what we can do to make it easier for us to notice our thoughts when things are difficult are things that we might do on our own. But it's also, of course, helpful to reach out to others. In fact, I would say probably like through history, right? Things, we were much more, as humans, much more a part of community and dealt with difficulties communally and perhaps maybe even had rituals to kind of mark passages and the endings of things that we don't tend to have so much these days. So maybe something that might be supportive would be to going to coffee with a friend, going to dinner with a friend, going to lunch, going for a walk, whatever it might be. Maybe you talk about your difficulties, maybe you don't. Whatever feels like the right thing to do. Maybe playing a group sport, playing tennis, playing soccer, just doing something with another group of people, in some way kind of feeling connected. Softball, bocce ball. Some physical intimacy with our partners. And again, with this, we can recognize that there are some helpful ways and perhaps some less helpful ways in which we may do to support ourselves when we're having difficulties. And then just notice which ones are more helpful, and can you organize your life, try to do it so that you use those strategies more often, the helpful, supportive ones. There's one type of thought I'd like to spend a little more time on. This is a type of thought that often goes under the radar, that we don't notice because it seems so familiar, it seems so matter of fact, it seems like it's just the truth. Why would I notice that? It's just the way it is. This is a thought of self-criticism. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh God, I hope nobody noticed. Oh, that other person, they can do it, but I can't do it. Oh, I'll never be good at this. Oh, I shouldn't do this. I'm not a good meditator. Look how many thoughts I'm having. These can be so common. If we start to pay attention to them, you could see how often that we are beating ourselves up, how we have the not giving ourselves the space to have the range of human experiences. We have these unrealistic expectations of how we should behave. So often we are, what's this word I hear? We are mercilessly hard on ourselves for our defeats, our losses, the hurts, the wounds, what we think are failures. We're so hard on ourselves. Those parts that we think don't measure up. Can we notice these and somehow take away some of the authority that they have? These are thoughts too. They arise and pass away. Doesn't make them the truth. They're real, we do have them, but that's not the truth. We're not these awful people. We make mistakes, we're humans. So often, in order to kind of support people with self-criticism, is the practice of self-compassion, like the opposite of self-compassion. We can define compassion as to notice suffering, notice difficulties, and the wish, the sincere wish for it to end. If you've been hanging out in the Buddhist scene, that you know that part of the practice is to recognize suffering when it arises, and as best we can to have compassion. And in the classic Buddhist teaching, self-compassion isn't pulled out or highlighted as anything special as compassion for everybody else. It's just, and compassion for ourselves, it's all included. But I think in contemporary times, well, I know in contemporary times there's been an emphasis on self-compassion because self-criticism is so pervasive and so difficult. Difficult to see, difficult to work with, we tend to believe it. Even though it undermines us, undermines our best efforts. So with self-compassion, we treat ourselves in the way we would treat a friend. If a friend were having difficulty, what would we say to that friend? What would we do for that friend? Can we do a similar thing for ourselves? Can we say the same thing to ourselves? So imagine that a close friend of yours, somebody that you care about, calls you after she just got dumped by her partner. She's completely heartbroken. She's just sad and in tears. And you respond, you're on the phone perhaps, and you're saying, well, to be perfectly honest, your partner probably left you because you're old, ugly, and boring. You're also so needy. You're so dependent. And you're at least 20 pounds overweight. And wow, and your hair is graying. I just give up now. Because really, there's no hope of finding anyone who will ever love you. Can you imagine saying that to somebody? That's awful, right? But somehow, sometimes, there's some version of this that we say to ourselves. It's awful. We say things to ourselves we would never say to other people. Can we treat ourselves with the same respect and the same kindness that we would treat others? This is what self-compassion is. Self-compassion is just recognizing, yes, we make mistakes. Yes, may have caused harm on others. We may have caused harm to ourselves. Can we make amends? Can we fix it? Can we go forward? But resilience is about being able to recognize that we make mistakes and not getting stuck in this self-recrimination, this rumination about how terrible we are because we did that thing. Notice when we do harm. Feel the remorse. But feel the remorse about the harm that was caused, the mistakes that we've made, without making it about like, oh, I'm a bad person. Look at me, I'm a bad person, and here's all the data to support why I'm a bad person. Me, bad person, bad person, bad person. Can we soften that a little bit? This is not easy. If this is a lifelong habit, it's not easy. But can we at least just soften or just begin with noticing? Oh, okay. Here's those kinds of thoughts. These thoughts arise and pass away too. Can we just take away a little bit of their authority? Just because we think these thoughts frequently, you may not, if you think them frequently, doesn't mean they're true. I speak from experience also. There was a time in my life when, wow, I was so hard on myself. A lot of suffering. And I had this idea that I had to be critical. Otherwise, I would just hang out eating bonbons all day or something. I don't know what I thought I had. I thought that was the only way to get ahead, to get more and more and more, right? I had to, like, be mean to myself. Turns out there's actually quite a bit of scientific research on this idea of self-compassion, which isn't pretending like nothing that bad ever happened. Like, self-compassion is noticing the difficulty, noticing the suffering, and noticing the harm, and being with it on an honest, approaching it with reverence type of way, versus self-criticism. And the research comes back that turns out that people that have self-compassion tend to be more successful in a number of different ways that you want to measure success. Professional success, getting jobs that they wanted. Personal success, having the nature of relationships that they wanted. And the reason is because they're more willing to take risks. They're more willing to be authentic. They're more willing to be real. If you have a habit of criticizing yourself every time you make a little mistake, you don't want to make a mistake. Then your life starts to get a little bit smaller and smaller as you try to do safe and only do those things that have a really high likelihood of succeeding. But if you're able to do some compassion to cut yourself some slack when you make a mistake, then your life gets bigger. Take a little bit more chances. A little bit more success, do things you hadn't done before. Life becomes a little bit more satisfying. So actively practicing self-compassion. So how can we do that? Some of you may know that kind of in the Buddhist world, there are formal practices to do this. This is something that can be cultivated and developed. I actually love this because it's not this idea like, okay, either you have it or you don't. Like, you know, the settings that we all came with can be like adjusted. So without going into all the details, I'll say this, that Kristen Neff is a person who teaches about self-compassion. She teaches it in a completely 100% secular way. She has a Buddhist background, but you wouldn't know that if by the way that she teaches. I'm not going to talk specifically about that, but if you are interested in this, you can Google it, and Kristen Neff and self-compassion. She has lots of practices and books and talks, and there's some people here in the Bay Area that teach, have been trained by her and that are teaching. But I'll say self-compassion often can come out of a loving-kindness practice, which can be a meditation practice. And this is just wishing ourselves well, wishing ourselves happiness, wishing ourselves safety, wishing ourselves health, some ease. I imagine those of you who have been coming here for a while, there's been some teachings on loving kindness. This is a common topic. Some people will dedicate, you know, they'll say something like, okay, I'm going to use the next year with my meditation practice. I know everybody talks about mindfulness and breathing. I'm actually going to be doing loving kindness practice. Just people feel like that's where the area of their life that can use some attention, it's what's accessible to them, what feels the most fruitful and ripe and real for them. I think we can honor these things that are happening. We don't have to struggle with our meditation practice. It's to benefit us and support us. I say this also with an encouragement to just try something, stick it out for a little bit. But if it doesn't work, if the person sitting up here is insisting on one thing and you find yourself struggling, just see if there's an easier way. Struggling is not the way to build greater capacity in terms of, we just are, in some ways struggling, we're just cultivating some ill will and impatience. Like, when is that dang bell going to ring, right? So I say this, I'm a teacher that I like to say to support people finding their own way. Not all teachers will say this. Some teachers will say, you know, here's one way, and even if it's difficult for you, you will learn something from this. And that's a great way too. So my encouragement is to find your way, to be a little bit more experimental and to try things, or to find one way to do things and to stick with that. I do think that not one way works for absolutely everybody. That's my view. So an encouragement for you to find your own way with meditation practice, including self-compassion. So getting a little bit back to self-compassion, another reason why self-compassion can help support our lives as opposed to self-criticism is it motivates us to make those needed changes in our lives. Maybe we noticed those things that strategies that we use when difficulties arise are not helpful. Maybe some self-compassion can help us to make those changes so that we're not doing that, not because we're beating ourselves up, but because we care about ourselves, because we want to do what is best for ourselves. So self-compassion helps create the conditions in which our life can grow and become better and better and flourish. So it inclines us more towards long-term health and well-being. And to be clear, self-compassion is not about short-term pleasure. It's not about just always eating ice cream whenever difficulties arise or whatever it might be. It's noticing our difficulties, turning towards them as best we can. There may be times when the most difficult difficulties feel a little bit out of our capacity, and then we can just notice them and as best we can bring our attention to something else. Notice them and bring as best we can our attention to something else. If it doesn't feel overwhelming, we can be with the difficulty. Can we hold it? Can we approach it with reverence? Can we notice? Just notice the experience in the body. I haven't talked about that so much this evening. I've been talking primarily about the notice the thoughts, the quality of the thoughts, the nature of the thoughts. maybe I'll summarize by saying to realize resilience. Part of that is to notice that we have a range of thoughts, and some of them are difficult. Can we notice them? Notice that they arise and pass away. Notice as best we can. Can we notice that we have a mixture of thoughts? Maybe some of them are not the best versions of ourselves, let us say, and some of them aren't. Can we also notice those thoughts that are self-critical? Those tend to really undermine us, and we don't often notice them. It might be that you're meditating and maybe your attention is on the breath, and then you notice like, oh, yeah, okay, here I am. I'm just woke up to being fantasizing about what I'm going to eat later. And then there might be this other thought like, oh, you're always thinking about food. And then you come back, or like, oh, you're not on the thoughts. Or there might be this little quiet whisper of a thought. Can we notice those? And then can we bring compassion to ourselves? Like, okay, here we are being critical again. Can you notice that with reverence, the criticalness with reverence? And to explore with whether having a loving kindness practice, or for those of you maybe familiar with a more formal compassion practice or a more formal self-compassion practice, does that support you to have this resilience? Resilience, the sense of movement, the sense that things are possible, of not being stuck. Resilience doesn't mean we never experience difficulties, doesn't mean we never have pain again. It doesn't mean that everything is easy peasy all the time. It just means that things are able to move through, that there's a sense of things will be different, or being stuck is the opposite of, I don't know, the opposite of, this feeling of being stuck is often where overwhelm comes from, or difficulties. So I think I'll end here with a wish that you may experience some peace, some ease, some well-being, and you might notice that yourself having some pleasant, supportive, helpful thoughts, as well as some of the difficult ones. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.